Yeah, it's been a long haul, and it's not over. We're kind of hoping this is the beginning of a next wave of influencing with the outcome of 2031. I just wanted to thank, because I was a coordinator, but there were a lot of people involved. I won't list the whole 500, but in the room, William Fisher was really managing the secretariat out of Clark. Nancy was working on that team, and then the number of, and also co-directs the social drivers group. We have Caitlin Christensen, who managed the science and technology group, and just to acknowledge their work, it has been a very collective effort. Anyway, I'm gonna, because I wasn't sure of how much people knew about 2031, I think a lot of people have heard of it, and some people probably haven't heard about it, but I thought I would start by giving you a quick rundown of how it got started and how it's run, and then move into some of the preliminary findings and then some highlights of the recommendations. But I don't want to get too much into that because I want to encourage you to look forward to the launch of the book in December, which will it's called AIDS, Taking a Long-Term View. We have a number of other publications coming out that are more journals and articles. But the title of the talk we put beyond 2015 in light of the current attention to MDGs. I mean, there's been a long term, but with what's happening in New York. I went back and forth about specifically tying this to aspects of the MDGs and decided not to. But I do want to say that the overall point, one of the points of 2031, was to stretch our horizon longer term. A lot of times with goals, you want something that are specific and deliverable, but I don't know how many times in global and international health we get there and then we push it just a bit further, whether it's polio eradication or whether it's malaria eradication, which we were trying to do many years ago, or whether it was population or whatever the issue, we always kind of get close and push it a bit further. So another option is to start further and then look incrementally in how you get there. Because 2015 is actually kind of around the corner. So it's really more the context of the relation to MDGs is just for those involved in any way with the summit next week, to think about 2015, then what? And with AIDS, I think we're hoping that some of the work around AIDS 2031 will influence some of the other global health targets to kind of start stretching their horizons a bit further. Why AIDS 2031? Well, the concept for it got started in 2006, which was the 2006. It was 25 years of AIDS, and Peter Piot at the conference in Vancouver, the International AIDS Conference, said, you know, everybody is looking back at the last 25 years and who's looking at the next 25 years, and that's where the idea for 2031 was born. Well, we should, and then a few people got together and that group grew, and it was quite, it evolved very organically, and then at one point we realized we needed to create a secretariat and get some management of it, but it was clear that there was a hunger for something different that looked at a shift. The other aspect about 2031 is AIDS was a brand new, well, it was older than we thought, but was a brand new disease when it was first reported, and it was very much an emergency. People were dying very quickly. And so the first couple decades of the response were very much in an emergency mode, short term, fix it, you know, catch up with it. And in the very beginning, there was even some thoughts it was an outbreak that could be managed and contained. It's absolutely clear to us now that that's no longer the case. It's become endemic. It's and still moving faster than we are. So that also implies a change in the way of working. the emergency response, while there are some settings like in Southern Africa and Swaziland that are absolutely persisting emergencies, overall we need to shift the way we're working to be one that's more long-term, that has a different approach. So recognizing that for every two people getting treated, there were five new infections, we're still behind the curve, we need to shift the way we're working. That was the whole point of 2031. Initially, we had some activists kind of grumbling and upset that we were thinking, what are you doing thinking about 2031? We still have so much work to do right now. And we realized that we had to be clearer in our communication and say, this isn't about what you do in 2031, it's about what you do now to change the face of AIDS by 2031. So that became a bit of a, you know, second line to anyone we talk to AIDS 2031 about. The idea was to generate new evidence to inform the response over the next couple decades, not throwing out what we've done in any sense of the word, but to really build on the first three decades. We know a lot more than we did when AIDS was first reported in 1981. And one of the things that's learned is we really absolutely need an interdisciplinary approach. I think the response had already recognized that. That was why UNAIDS was created. It was clear that a health-centric approach was not going to be appropriate for the response. And for people pushing health systems, that will work, will maybe support the treatment, but as most prevention actually happens totally outside of the health sector. So a multidisciplinary approach, we thought, to the initiative was very important. We set up 9 working groups, and this was initiated by UNAIDS, but there was a very strong sense that it needed an independent secretariat, which was set up at Clark University, and the working groups hosted by different entities, because there was a strong sense by the people involved that we didn't want UN editorial process. We wanted to be able to say what we wanted to say, we wanted to say it clear, we wanted to say it strong, and we wanted to be a resource to the UN and the broader global health community. The initial funding, really the significant foundational funding to get this off the ground was, interestingly, from one of the smallest, if not smallest, countries in the world, the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg. And their interest in funding this initiative was that they were absolutely deeply worried about the slipping of the prevention agenda. That was, they said, if there's one thing we want this initiative to do is wake up the world that we cannot be, with the advent of treatment, put all our eggs in that basket and lose the plot on prevention. So they said, you do it in whatever way you need to do it, but that's our concern and that's why we're putting this investment on the table. And then others came along, the Gates Foundation, AMFAR, Google.org, Irish Aid, Merck Foundation, a couple of additional funds from different UN agencies, and the Packard Foundation. What were our deliverables? Well, one was, initially we've been calling it AIDS, an agenda for the future, but in the last 6 months there was a sense that for a more public book, an agenda for the future might sound a bit UN-ish, even though we made all those efforts to step a bit far away from it. So we've opted to call it what it is, which is AIDS taking a long-term view. It will be published in mid-December with the Financial Times Science Press. I think there's already a little thumbnail on Amazon Books that it'll come out then. But we will launch it officially on World AIDS Day. The books will be in the store mid-December. We also have a series of working group papers, which are on the AIDS 2031 website, and a number of synthesis reports from the different working groups. There are a number of which are here, and then some of the papers have also been in journal publications, and some of them are in the process of that right now. We also did a series in collaboration with BBC World called Love in a Time of HIV, And that follows five young people living with HIV in five cities around the world, because one of the messages of AIDS 2031 is the importance of settings. And that was shot in New York, in London, in Cape Town, and in Bombay, and in St. Petersburg. And it's really looking at what is it like as a young person living with HIV. It's not a big and they're not big and scary stories. They're very genuine. They're very real. And they were shot by young people, so they're very candid. And all five of them you can see on the website. We've also established, because this is about the future, we thought it was very important to engage young people, and we started a Young Leaders Network that was initially supported by Google.org, and we had our first Young Leaders powwow, as it were, at the Googleplex, they call it, in Mountain View, and had a second Young Leaders event in the spring, hosted by the Prince and Princess of Norway, who have become very proactive with 2031, and hosted the event there. Out of this Young Leaders group, and this was also with some seed funding from the foundation, which is run by the Princess of Norway and Ford Foundation, they've started a Young Leaders Fund, which is to give kind of small, they realized just a little bit of funding for some of these young-led initiatives really would help get a number of these to try to support the energy that was happening from young people who couldn't necessarily get some of that initial capital to get off the ground. And we realized they also did a lot more with a little money than most of the international development community. So we wanted to encourage that. How has it worked? We have the coordinating unit at Clark, but we had these nine working groups. Leadership was co-hosted by UNAIDS and Social Science Research Council. Communication by Communication for Social Change. Programmatic response was jointly was also hosted by UNAIDS. Science and Technology was hosted by PATH. The special look at hyperendemic countries was hosted by the Nelson Mandela Foundation in Johannesburg. Special look at countries in rapid transition was co-hosted by University of South Korea and UNAIDS Bangkok. Modeling the epidemic was hosted by Imperial College in London. Social drivers co-hosted by International Center for Research on Women and Clark University. Financing the response by Brookings, Results for Development, and Georgetown University. And the steering committee became the chairs of those initiatives, and the steering committee was chaired by Steph Bertozzi. And we had an international advisory group that really was more of a throwing the ideas to them for some independent feedback, and that group was chaired by Peter Piat. I'm sorry for the next series of slides that are all text. I didn't put a lot of fancy pictures, but anyway. I was trying to be creative with the words. I think the headline is AIDS is not over. And I think that we have a whole, I was saying this in another meeting this morning, one of the things that we were kind of surprised by was how difficult it was for a lot of people working in the AIDS community for a long time, how hard it was for them to understand that outside of that community, a lot of people really didn't know what the level of the scope of the epidemic is, that there was a whole new generation and a whole new cohort of people who are not seeing it in the way that people 40 and 50 plus years old saw, that there was a new generation who never saw the big scary parts of AIDS in the beginning, that it was a different perception, that we really did need to do a new wave of awareness about what the state of the epidemic is. One of the things that we recognize is that the state of the epidemic is not a global homogeneous pandemic. It didn't just expand out from Africa or the U.S. or the and go around the world. It's right now a lot of separate epidemics with very different characteristics, different drivers, and that they need to be looked at in that way, that we really need a much clearer assessment of the socio-political, economic, and cultural drivers that define the epidemics in our response. The other thing is the epidemic has continually confounded us with new surprises. We think we've put the fire out here, and meanwhile it's burning behind us. We have, you know, things under control. We never thought that right now in 2010, the fastest growing epidemic in the world would be in Russia. It really is outpacing every other part of the world, and it's been extremely hard to get the policies in place that are going to be the only thing that's going to bring it under control, aside from some of the behaviors, but they go hand in hand. We have some progress, but it's real but fragile. If we lose pace, the pace we have now, we're going to be in trouble. If we do, even with the pace we have now, we're seeing that we will still, if we continue with the same level of investment and the same rate of prevention and treatment investments, we will still see 1 million new infections a year in 2031. If we drop any more, it's going to be worse, and to make any bigger dent, we're going to need to do a lot more. And there's no way we can even think about eliminating without a technology breakthrough, whether it's a vaccine or a cure. And we are not close to either. We have some incremental increases in progress, but to get those up and running, accepted, and out there won't be by 2031. In some of the modeling we did, we did modeling with 22 countries around the world, or the modeling group did. And just to give an example of the state of things, if we look at the potential of how many new infections could be averted, if we just continue as we are now, you can see here how bad it would be. That's the light green. Just that's continuing to do everything we're doing now without cutting 1 cent and actually having to increase to keep up with the rate. And the darker green is with an expanded investment, and you still see we have quite a few. One of the dynamics here is population growth. In Africa, a number of these countries, some of them actually have already stabilized, but even though they've stabilized or in fact even dropped in some cases in terms of the rate of new infections, the number of infections is growing because of population growth. It's going to have a massive impact on the amount of HIV in Africa moving forward in the future. We have three different scenarios with Africa. Some countries have stabilized, some have dropped in new infections, and some are slightly increasing. And every single one of them, even when they've dropped because of population growth, they're going to have reasonable to serious amount of infections by 2031.
Hey, just a question on that slide. Mm-hmm. So what, can you generally describe what are the expanded inputs that would cause the decrease represented by the darker green? What types of things were you calculating or including in that?
It was basically the intensity. I mean, a lot of, right now in some of these, prevention might be reaching, you might have like, I'm just giving an example. If one country had, for instance, like they were saying, 30% condom coverage and 22% circumcision and other behavioral interventions, and all that was brought up to another level.
So going more deeply.
Reaching more people, going more mm-hmm. deeply, further investment. It's not necessarily adding new things. It's in the pocket of things we have now. Mm-hmm. Questionable financial outlook, that's clear, anybody who reads the newspaper. We also saw, and one of the big messages of the final report is going to be on efficiency. We really felt like we could do much better, that the money that's out there is not being used in the best way it can be. Initially, that was totally understandable because we had to kind of throw everything we had in our toolkits at everybody because we weren't sure what was going to work where. It was understandable. It was a new epidemic. We had to try everything we could. But at this point, 3 decades into it, we have a lot more understanding, and we have no excuse for inefficiency. We need much better targeting, particularly of prevention efforts. And we also saw the critical importance of settings, the experience of people living with HIV, and the conditions under which people are more vulnerable varies radically from one setting to another. So we really have to think about programs and investments to be much more specific to an understanding of what the setting is. I'm sure many of you have heard the term "know your epidemic," know your response. And initially that got started with knowing the rate of infections, but in the report we talk about it much more in terms of knowing not only the rate of infections, but the economics, the politics, and the sociocultural dimensions. From a geographic point of view, it's absolutely clear that there will continue to need an exceptional response in hyperendemic settings, and that is primarily in southern Africa. The situation is bad, it continues to be bad, and it will still be undoubtedly the worst area in the world unless we have some big surprises. We can be assured that there's going to, I mean, not in a positive sense, but be pretty sure that by 2031 that will still need a sustained amount of investment, and it's not an area that can afford it itself, except for perhaps South Africa. From a donor perspective, we can count on continued needs there. In Asia, it's a very different story. The Working Group on Countries in Rapid Economic Transitions anticipate that by 2031, many of the countries in Asia will be able to fund their own AIDS programs. But that's not the concern or the problem of the report. It said even with all the resources to fund their own problems, the real sticking point will be, will they have the political guts, so to speak, to implement the policies that will make a difference, particularly around harm reduction and around sex work. There are explosive epidemics also among MSM. That's less of a policy issue, and that's more access to services. But there's also, depending on which area, issues around access to harm reduction. One of the things we saw in getting back to the settings is there were not only surprises in where the epidemic itself came up, but how different countries dealt with them. Countries that you wouldn't expect to be progressive in some areas, Iran and China, were actually two of the most progressive countries in the world when it came to harm reduction policies. Who would have thought? And we learned that you can't judge a country in its totalness, that a number of countries may be kind of progressive in one area and way behind in another, and that really we need to not talk about good country, bad country, but really unpack it much more and recognize the diversity and sometimes what seems contradictory policies. I mean, including in the U.S., we're way behind in terms of kind of a liberalized harm reduction policy and more progressive with giving some of the biggest investment in the world around treatment. Hi. From a kind of looking back at the first 3 decades, it's very clear that there's been, for people who say AIDS has had enough money, give it elsewhere, it's not really honestly looking at the positive or collateral benefits of what the AIDS response has done now. The Global Fund, for instance, is not the Global Fund for AIDS. It's the Global Fund for AIDS, TB, and malaria. TB and malaria would not have gotten that money without the attention to AIDS. And there were, the AIDS response has, in other areas, it's also pushed a lot of the whole gay rights agenda, which would not have gotten it had its own momentum without a doubt, but it's added another issue. It's the AIDS response has brought issues more broadly out of the closet, as it were, or things that were too sensitive to deal with by governments were pushed when it was an epidemic, an emergency, that people were dying, which kind of persuaded, nudged countries that might not have wanted to touch some issues to say, this is life or death, we need to do something about it. The problem is, now that it's not the emergency it was in terms of numbers of people dying so quickly, the risk, and this was already starting to become clear in one of the recent UNGAS, is the UN special session on AIDS, that some countries are starting to backtrack on some of the more progressive steps they had made. So you can have positive social change and you can have negative social change, and the big risk is that the gains that we've made slip. So we can't let go. We have to keep going. Another finding has been absolutely clearly that as much as we've learned and as far as we've got, stigma, discrimination, and marginalization persist horribly. There's still reports all over the world about the stigmatizing discrimination, the experience of people living with HIV, as well as even access to services and prevention, and it's still a big problem. More, and again, it's setting specific, but is something we should not underestimate. And that there's truly inadequate support for HIV prevention. That really it absolutely needs more investment, needs more edginess, it needs more progressive policies, and without that, we're really not going to make the headway that is absolutely needed. The other part about the support for HIV prevention is not just in its totality, but where it's being targeted. There's been a lot of analysis at country level of where actual money's going, and country after country, you see that the investment is not where the problem is. The investment is in something that's a little less politically sensitive, like media campaigns, rather than, and not in the investment in the area, whether it's MSM or drugs or sex work or youth, whatever the issue is. The money tends to go for the least sensitive, least politically difficult, and not necessarily where the problem is. And that needs to change. We've recognized in the reports, particularly in the science and technology group, that there are achievements, but there's also been limitations to science. We've had a revolution in the AIDS response because of antiretroviral therapy, but we're far from that vaccine that Margaret Heckler said many years ago we would have in 2 years. And we've had many other statements along those lines that have been have not come true. We've also really not dealt with, there's been a lot of talk and recognition about dealing with the structural and social drivers that drive risk and vulnerability, but there really haven't been the investments in them. In our instinct to find short-term measurable gains, the tendency is always to put things that give you a quicker win and not ones that really need a longer-term investment to see the impact. So that's one of the messages. And then, as I said in the beginning, the epidemic is still moving quicker than we are. These are just a few highlights of some of the recommendations. It's not all of them. They're more and in more detail with more story in the book. But a key one is about efficiency and targeting, giving prevention the priority it deserves. Universal and sustained access to affordable treatment. We talk about universal access to treatment for people who need it, but we say prevention maybe doesn't need universal access. Prevention should be very much specific and targeted and tailored to where it's needed. So we can save money that way, and it's also more efficient. We talk about a new code of conduct for the AIDS response, and that includes one of the things the Social Drivers Group came up with, which was a minimum legal standard around issues like decriminalizing harm reduction and issues related to it, and a few other stigma-related issues. We talk about long-term financing, and more specifically, to get countries to think about 10 to 20-year budget horizons, not 1 to 2 or even 5. Because to get some of the longer-term goals, you don't get there because your indicators for long-term impact are not going to happen in 2 years. So we need to start thinking about indicators that have longer-term, maybe past the political time of a leader, which is always hard because leaders only want to see impact in their during their tenure. We need different kinds of incentives. And we need a kind of revitalization of leadership around AIDS. It's a new generation. We need to get a different engagement going, and that's really what 2031 is about. And that's the website, which if you haven't seen it before, you should go see it. Hello, John. our funder. Our initiator. you know all this anyway, right here.
So is that
the
formal presentation?
That's the end of the formal. I'm sorry. I hope you're not, you've all still have your eyes
you.
Half open.
No, I think.